I want to thank you all and welcome you to the Stephen Hawking Center at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. My name is Maria Antonakis. I'm the Director of Advancement at Perimeter Institute. And we're so grateful that you all could spend time with us this afternoon. Opportunities to pause, to reflect, to listen, and to share are rare. And we are grateful for this opportunity with you here this afternoon. I think some of our guests are still arriving. Just have a seat and please, please help yourselves to the food and the beverages at the table. We're here to share and learn and also to be nourished. So enjoy the wonderful food from our bistro staff. I'd like to take a few moments to introduce some key members of the Perimeter team and also the partnering organization TD, which has made this afternoon possible for us. So I would like to introduce you now to Michael Duchenne, the Chief Operating Officer and Managing Director of Perimeter Institute, to say a few words about Perimeter.
Thank you very much, Maria. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Great, great pleasure on behalf of all of us here at Perimeter to welcome you here. As Maria said, you are in the Stephen Hawking Center. This is the Black Hole Bistro of the Stephen Hawking Center at Perimeter Institute. Stephen Hawking is a distinguished visiting research chair at Perimeter, has been a huge, huge supporter of the Institute. We owe him a great debt of gratitude. Very, very supportive, comes and visits us when his health permits. And this is actually the first time he has ever lent his name to an Institute. So we feel very, very honored. So you're in the Stephen Hawking Center within Perimeter Institute, the whole Institute, which is now the largest theoretical physics institute in the world. This new part of the building over here is the Stephen Hawking Center within PI. So welcome. Great to have all of you here. Tremendous pleasure to host this event on a topic that is very dear to our hearts here at Perimeter, women in philanthropy, and in particular, women in philanthropy supporting scientific endeavor, which you'll hear a lot more about this afternoon. I want to start by thanking TD. Michael, thank you so much for sponsoring us, for hosting us, and even more importantly to TD for furthering this very, very important conversation writ large. So as I said, you're at the Hawking Center at Perimeter. Perimeter was founded in 1999, so we're only 15 years old, but now, as I said, the largest theoretical physics institute in the world, considered internationally one of the top, maybe one, two, three institutes of its kind on the planet. So we've made a lot of progress very, very quickly. This is the brainchild, the vision of Mike Lazaridis, whom you know as the inventor of the smartphone. Perimeter, when Mike came up with this idea, has nothing to do with RIM, had nothing to do with the BlackBerry. This had to do with Mike's deep, deep belief in the importance of investing in basic research in young people, in science education. And he saw what he thought was an enormous opportunity that many had missed, to invest in an area of research that has not been invested in very heavily or very strategically. Theoretical physics, many would argue, is one of the most productive fields in all of research. If you look at every piece of modern technology you use today, it has its roots in theoretical physics. So without Maxwell, no wireless communication. Without Einstein, no GPS, no MRI, no laser, and the list goes on and on. Understanding how the world works at its most fundamental level leads to not only enormous knowledge creation, it leads to new technologies and wealth creation. And just as researchers, scientists like Einstein and Maxwell, 100 years ago, were trying to understand how the laws of nature works, that is what's going on at Perimeter today. Understanding those laws of nature will lead to enormous knowledge and wealth and technological revolutions. This is something that Mike Lazaridis saw. He saw an enormous opportunity for Canada to lead the world in this field of research, invested himself very heavily soon after governments followed. Perimeter is now a very successful private-public partnership where since inception, about half of our funding has come from the public sector, half has come from the private sector, individuals, corporations, foundations who have followed in Mike's footsteps to establish what, as I said, has now become a world leader in theoretical physics. We are extremely indebted and very fortunate at Perimeter to have a number of leading women who are playing a big, big role on this front. Theoretical physics is a field of research that, it could safely be said, has not distinguished itself with the involvement of women. It's a very heavily male-dominated field. Perimeter likes to think that we can be at the cutting edge, not only of research and training and what we do outreach-wise with students, but that we have an opportunity to make a difference in that area as well. We have assembled some amazing women who sit on something called the Emmy Noether Council. Emmy Noether was a contemporary of Einstein's, one of the world's greatest mathematicians. We've named a circle after her. We have these amazing women on this this circle who are raising funds for all sorts of initiatives to further opportunities for women in this field, from girls who are being encouraged to take math and science in school right up to established researchers where we're providing scholarships, fellowships, and chairs. So very, very fortunate to have that involvement. And it's a piece of the Institute's mandate right now that has really vaulted right to the top of what we're trying to do, really trying to make a difference in that area. So very topical discussion for us this afternoon. Delighted that you're all here to join us, and I'm looking forward to a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. You've been a champion and a mentor to many of us here today, especially as the visionary executive champion of the Emmy Noether Initiative. And as you've mentioned, we'd launched this to empower and bring more women and girls into physics. And it's terrific you could make time to be with us. Events like this rely on the vision, enthusiasm, and partnerships of great people and great organizations. And Perimeter is grateful that Michael Dye and his group at TD, we have all three with Michael and his team. Michael Dye, Vice President and Market Manager at TD Wealth Private Client Group, is going to say a few words on behalf of TD Bank.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to say on my way here, my son called me. And I said, I don't have really a lot of time to talk to you. I'm having lunch with 40 women. And he said, Dad, we can talk tonight. So it's a pleasure to be here today on behalf of TD. I have some of my colleagues here with me. We represent TD Wealth within this community in the region. We have private banking, private trust, discretionary money management. So we have a full service and holistic approach to wealth. We're delighted to have one of our experts here with us, and you'll learn more about Joanne later on. But it's been a great partnership with the Perimeter Institute. We came down and had a tour, and we knew that this would be a great venue, a great opportunity for us to partner together to learn about a very important topic. I am sure and I know many of you are very philanthropic, involved in donating your time and expertise in the community, but we're going to learn more about that today. So on behalf of TD, thank you for coming out today. And on behalf of the Perimeter Institute and all of our panelists, really appreciate all your time and dedication to this important topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. There are times when you meet someone and you know that you'll be close allies for the long haul, and that was the case when I met Joanne Ryan, Vice President Philanthropy, Wealth Advisory Services, Executive Director Private Giving Foundation. Joanne is an advocate and champion for change in the philanthropic and financial sector. And I was just noting today that the Stanford Social Innovation Review has a cover that says, "Time for the Plural Sector." And I feel like this is a really great indicator of the power of women and our approach to how we communicate, how we build initiatives, and how we can change the world. The plural sector is the new word for the third sector, which was the old new word for the public sector. So as you can see, we're moving along in the charitable world, and I think the plural sector is really about us bringing our thoughts and our attention to collaboration. And Joanne does that beautifully. When I think of Joanne, I think of the quote: "I said somebody should do something about that. Then I realized I'm somebody." Joanne saw the opportunity for women to take a leadership role in philanthropy, and she and her team at TD seized the day to engage women across Canada to research, produce time, talent, treasure, Canadian women and philanthropy. It's a white paper that you will be receiving electronically if you haven't already received hard copies of it. Joanne has been traveling across Canada, delivering the findings of the report, and we are grateful that she is here with us today to share them. Come up.
Good afternoon, and welcome, everybody. It is a pleasure, an absolute pleasure, to be here at this amazing place. I'm really looking forward to doing a tour later. And it's my pleasure to present, as Maria said, the findings of the first thought leadership report on women and philanthropy in Canada. So there is information out there on women and philanthropy, but you'll find it's US-based, it's UK, it's Australian. There was never anything that was done that was really Canadian-based. And so we thought that it was about time. And this actually falls under our women investor strategy. We have learned over the years that women make investment decisions differently than men. We suspected that they probably made philanthropic decisions differently than men, and thought it would be a great project to undertake. We wanted the research to be independent, so we partnered with a company called Investor Economics, who did both quantitative and qualitative research. We had focus groups with women philanthropists right across the country. Obviously, this research wouldn't have been possible without the participation from passionate women who shared their opinions, valuable insights about charitable giving and philanthropy. So I'd like to start by just quantifying some of the stats about women and wealth. So at the end of 2012, women controlled approximately one-third of total household wealth in Canada, $3.2 trillion in total assets, in total assets, and in terms of financial assets, $1.1 trillion. In 2020, the level of financial wealth controlled by women will likely reach $3 trillion. Now, part of that, the wealth is from the what we talk about all the time in the financial services industry is the intergenerational wealth transfer. And the fact that women's life expectancy is longer than men, they're going to end up with majority of the money at the end of the day anyway. And in fact, Investor Economics has quantified that. And between 2012 and 2022, $896 billion in Canada is being transferred from one generation to the next. And out of that, approximately $600 billion is going to end up in the hands of women as either spouses, or daughters. However, the wealth transfer is not the only factor responsible for women's growing economic power. Between 2004 and 2011, average total income for women increased by 16% compared to a 6% increase with men. Women are more often becoming the number one breadwinner. And not only are women making up a greater percentage of the Canadian workforce, they're increasing their presence in managerial and executive levels in most economic sectors. Number of women sitting on corporate boards is increasing. We still need to see some improvement there. But certainly female business owners and entrepreneurs in Canada are gaining ground. And outside of the corporate world, it's interesting to note today, in Canada, 60% of all university graduates are women. So a sure measure that women are making more money can be seen as it relates to the amount of income tax that we pay. 2011, women contributed $54.7 billion in income tax, an increase of $6 billion over 2007. So guess that's a good news, bad news story. We're paying more tax. I guess that means we're making more money. When it comes to philanthropy and charitable giving, tax is not the number one motivator. In fact, the research clearly indicated the number one reason why women give stems from a desire to help those in need, a belief in the work undertaken by the charities. So how does tax fit in? Well, the way we describe it to our clients when it comes to philanthropy is if the, in our country, if you have any wealth or any income, those tax dollars, which we call your social capital, are going to make their way to Ottawa. So you have a choice of sitting back and letting the people in Ottawa decide how to allocate those funds. You may agree or disagree, or you can actually take control of that social capital and allocate them to causes that you care about. And, you know, again, tax isn't the number one motivator, but if you look at, you know, the beneficiaries of your wealth being family, friends, charities, and Canada Revenue Agency, most of our clients would like to minimize what Canada Revenue Agency gets, maximize what family and friends get. You're always going, even though the tax incentives for giving continuously have been improving, you're always going to still be out of pocket at the end of the day after making a gift. So you do have to have that philanthropic intent. And fortunately, many women in Canada do have philanthropy as an important part of their objective. How generous are Canadian women? In 2012, 2,590,000 Canadian women donated about $3 billion to charities, almost $1.1 billion more than 2002. In the last 10-year period, it's interesting to note the number of women donating increased by 9.1%, while the number of men donating decreased by 3.3%. Now, this isn't an exact science because whoever makes the donation, either spouse or partner, can claim it on their tax return. So what we're seeing now, most likely as a result of women's rising income, is more and more women are claiming the donation on their tax return, even though they were probably behind making the gift when their husbands were claiming it. And it's estimated that about 350,000 women in Canada have access to financial resources to make a major gift. And what we do with our clients, and we're certainly seeing a huge increase in philanthropy, is we encourage our clients to do a comprehensive financial plan. And sometimes that's where we actually, our clients will actually see on paper they have more money than they're ever going to need in their lifetime. And so why not start a philanthropic plan today? Another trend that we're seeing today is, even 15 years ago, if I was advising high net worth clients about their estate plan, probably the first thing out of their mouth is they would say, everything's going to my kids. And now as we sit with our high net worth clients and chat about their estate plan, the first thing out of their mouth is, my kids are not getting it all. And it's the Warren Buffett, you want to leave your kids enough to do anything, but not too much to do nothing. And in some cases, they just start bragging and saying, their kids are successful already. They've helped them with houses. They've helped them get going in business. They're successful. They don't need the money. And so philanthropy becomes a really important part of that planning. So what motivates women to give? All the women who participated in our focus groups were financially successful. Many did not grow up with wealth. In fact, in several instances, we heard their families had very little. Some grew up during the Depression. Some came from large families. Many women mentioned that giving was an embedded family value. It was also evident that women are unlikely to give up these values, and in fact, most go to great length to ensure those values are passed on to their children. And as such, many women philanthropists hold the view that the money available for giving is a family, not a personal asset, and the family should play a direct role in decision-making. Women who grew up in small communities were raised with a sense of wanting to help others. In fact, one participant spoke of growing up in a small community in the prairies and how her mother's vegetable garden fed half the town during times of hardship. Regardless how the wealth was accumulated, a common thread with these women is that they found themselves in the fortunate position of having more than they needed and wanting to make a difference in their lifetime. There's no question that certain events proved a catalyst to start a giving plan for some. In one instance, upon the death of her husband, one woman's philanthropy became centered around raising money for research in the disease that robbed him of his life. In another instance, upon the death of her husband, she set up a foundation to provide scholarships to aspiring artists, as her husband was passionate about art. Unlike men, women will often volunteer for a charity as a way to get to know them before making a sizable gift. Relationships with the people at the organizations are much more essential for women, and because women form long-term relationships with the organizations they support, most Canadian women support no more than 3 or 4 causes with major gifts. Supporting fewer also allows them to A, maintain the relationships, and B, have a greater impact. Despite similarities, Canadian women are not a homogenous group when it comes to the causes they support and how they give. However, rather than writing that simple check, they do take a very engaged approach. We had one participant who took her love of music and live concerts to support not the arts, but Baycrest, a hospital specializing in complex needs of aging seniors, 19 years ago, and then replicated it at Princess Margaret. And due to her generosity and creative vision, on a weekly basis, concerts provide much enjoyment and healing for patients, visitors, and staff at these hospitals. Another Toronto participant and philanthropist took her newfound passion for motorcycles to fund purchase of motorcycles to be used in Africa to transport people and supplies to very hard-to-reach places. There was a general consensus of the importance of funding education, particularly for women and girls. And I've learned firsthand from the Canadian Women's Foundation that when you help women, there is a ripple effect. Women go on to help their children, their families, and their communities, so investing in women is a very, very strong investment. Other interests included social justice, vulnerable youth, the arts, health-related causes, and social services. Some women were very committed to supporting local causes. They could see firsthand the results. Others combined their love of travel to support global causes. Where women were looking for a social return on their investment, it was pointed out that investing a dollar globally can be stretched very far. Women will conduct more due diligence before making a gift and after the gift to measure the impact. This could be reviewing financials, having discussions with board members, management, and of course, volunteering. We had one focus group participant who was funding organizations that were serving homeless youth. And she went right out to the street to talk to the homeless clients that were being served in order to assess the merits of the program. So what do charities need to do to tap into this huge potential? If the opportunities for growth are to be realized, it will require the participation of a broader community of women than at present. Charities need to raise their profiles with women by developing materials designed to encourage relationships rather than only the solicitation of a financial gift. One woman talked about how she was really interested in supporting an organization, then she got the material in the mail and it was so glossy and so expensive that it just turned her right off. Board of directors of charitable organizations tend to be male-dominated despite the fact that women are frequently employed as executives of charities and often represent the majority of donors and volunteers. Big one that came out in the focus groups is women want to see less competition among charities and more cooperation and collaboration. And, you know, I heard over and over again from the women that we spoke to that it sounds like this charity is doing similar work to that charity. Can't they just get together and work on something? And, in fact, one woman took the bold step. She wanted to fund a project, and it was in her view that if Charity A worked together with Charity B on the project, that they would have the superior result, 1 + 1 = 3. So she actually approached the two organizations and said, here's the potential money on the table. You two figure out how to work together, and guess what they did. Women are looking for access to sources of qualified advice that can assist them in developing their giving strategies. Social media has grown in importance as a tool for engaging and informing donors. Internet-based surveys indicate women are the majority of users of Twitter and Facebook, and Facebook account holders who follow one or more charities tend to be female under the age of 35. 56% of females following charities on Facebook endorse the charity to their friends. 30% of donors under 35 indicate involvement of charities and social media change their giving habits. So there's no question that a social media strategy should be an important part of reaching out to women. Some other ideas, reaching out to other women rather than waiting to be approached, holding philanthropic events for women, creating giving circles. And finally, charities need to avoid underthanking and over-asking. So one of the women in our focus group said, you know, she gets approached by a charity at Christmas and then at Easter and then at Thanksgiving and then on Mother's Day. And she actually went by and approached the charity and said, okay, I'm gonna support you. And you can solicit me once per year for funds. And in the event that I get more than one solicitation, then my support to you is cut off. And I think they got the message. So overall, the research report has shown that women have the ability to make significant change to our society through selfless acts of generosity, and there's a large untapped opportunity. The women who give so generously of their time, talent, and treasure personify the words of Margaret Mead, who wrote, "Never believe that a few caring people can't change the world, for indeed that's all who ever have." Thank you.
Thank you so much, Joanne. It's a fantastic report, and this is just a terrific way to launch it in this community. The great thing about this work is that the time and the talent and the treasure that's been invested by the researchers or the philanthropists across the country who took time to participate in the research, that work is something that we can all benefit from and learn from. And so we're very happy to have you here with us today and share it. I want to thank TD also for paving the way for this conversation with this group of panelists. I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to introduce you and to also hear your questions and commentary, or your answers and commentary on some questions that we've been thinking about around women in philanthropy, women in leadership. Mentors, friends, leaders, frontrunners of change, sisters, mothers, mavericks, these are all words that can be described and used to apply to our panelists. You have bios of everyone on the panel in your program, so take them, digest them, and for now, listen and be, I hope, inspired by their words of wisdom. I'd like to introduce you to Sherry Vanstone, President and CEO, TrustPoint Innovation, and an Emmy Noether Council member, Sherry. Lynn Baptist, the Chair of the J.W. McConnell Family Foundation, Lynn. Joanne Fideco, Executive Director of the C100. And Michelle Osry, partner, Deloitte, and also a member of our Emmy Noether Council. Each panelist is going to open with remarks on their work and how philanthropy plays a role in their life. And then I'll come back to each one of them to ask a few more questions. So Sherry, why don't we start with you?
Maria, certainly an honor to be here today. Maria's asked for me to give you a brief background on myself and the work that I'm doing and how philanthropy has played a role in my life. I am, as Maria mentioned, the CEO and president of TrustPoint. How did I get here via being a mathematician? And how did I do that? I started out in high school as a mathematician, thinking I wanted to study mathematics. And I had two other close high school friends who were also good at math, girlfriends. And we ran the math and science club at high school. But one of my friends had cystic fibrosis, and she died shortly after high school. And so that was when I said, yeah, I'm going to start giving whatever I had at that time. So cystic fibrosis was one of the foundations I chose. So it's about choosing something that speaks to you. That's what Joanne was talking about in the survey that you did. And I feel that certainly that's what's played out in my life going forward. As soon as I could start supporting, as I said, I did. And after I've been very lucky, and I made part of that luck through my education as being a mathematician. It's opened a lot of doors for me. I've been involved in two successful startups, and that's given an opportunity for me to play a role in this in the philanthropy area. My late husband and I started early on, and we started a family scholarship fund for our nieces and nephews. So we understood the value of education. And so that's, again, finding something that you say, this is valuable to me, and I think it could be valuable to other people, too. And I also started a scholarship in my mom and dad's name for my high school. I chose every year a young lady who was going to study mathematics and put some money in there so that I get, again, giving back, saying mathematics is very important to me, and I believe it's going to be important to some other young women. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. Thank you very much. And Lynn, how about a few words from you?
Well, when I was thinking about... I really have been wearing several hats, but the main hats that I've been wearing lately are, one is as a funder. I chair our family foundation, the J.W. McConnell Family Foundation. I am the first great-grandchild to sit on the foundation. It was founded 75 years ago by my great-grandfather. And if I trace my philanthropy, it probably goes back to his example, because you can imagine in 1937, there weren't a lot of philanthropic donors around. And I looked at his past, and he grew up in a small community. I think it was a very rough life. They were given land up in northern Ontario, and it was mainly rock and stumps, not really the great farming land that they expected. So he always believed in giving back to his community and to helping vulnerable populations. And so I've been sitting on the foundation now for about 20 years, and I've been the chair for the past five. I realized thinking back that the last three chairs have been women, and I'm proud of that because I think as women we really are leaders and we lead with our heart, and but at the same time we do our homework and we like to do strategic planning, and we really want to make a difference, and that's really important. And in my foundation work, it's quite amazing to me that after 75 years, we are still an all-family blood relative board of 14 family members. I have a staff of 22 people. About 20 years ago, we decided to do more national-based philanthropy to try to scale the impact of great models and projects. And in the last years, we have been leaders in helping and supporting the development of social innovation, social enterprise, and social finance. So that's been really exciting. And I'm really proud when I look at my board, which is actually mostly women, but quite balanced, that we're real risk takers. And we believe that we have the ability to take risks with the money that we grant. And we've been very successful at doing that. The other hat that I wear is as a fundraiser, and I have been involved with a children's mental health program for almost 20 years, and we're now at the point where we're scaling it across Canada through a venture philanthropy model. And so my two worlds have really collided, and it's been amazingly helpful understanding what it's like to be a grantor of funds and then be on the other side when you're asking for money. And when I look at philanthropy, I have to say my family are the biggest influence in my life. They always believed in giving back. I have two daughters that are following in my footsteps, which makes me very proud and happy. And I think, you know, I was thinking back too that when I was young, I guess I was about 15, 16, and I went and volunteered at the Montreal Children's Hospital. And my dad took me aside and he said, "This is really great what you're doing." He said, "I'm going to give you a little pocket money just to acknowledge, you know, the good work that you're doing." Well, that translated into me becoming a child life specialist at the Montreal Children's Hospital. So just showed me the volunteering and how it moved towards, you know, what my career path was. So I think the other thing that's important to me is that philanthropy isn't just about money. It's just about just as much about time, the time that you put in. And I feel that one thing when I'm fundraising, the other thing with monetary gifts, I always say to people that every gift is a major gift. And I think that's really important. And I know Maria's, you know, talking about what holds women back. I think some women feel that they can't give enough, and so then they're not going to. But that's just not the right attitude to take. And in terms of time, I think that volunteering is the most amazing thing that women can do, because, you know, we're all passionate about things. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you very much. I love that. Every gift is a big gift. It really is. So, and Joanne?
So I think there might be something with growing up on a farm. I grew up along the 59th parallel in northern Alberta, where my father and grandfather homesteaded the land, so I picked a lot of rocks and roots in my days. And I think both my parents instilled a mythology of giving back, and I didn't actually realize it until, you know, many decades later, actually. So I got my accounting designation in Edmonton, and I did that because I thought it would just open up a bunch of doors for me. Somebody told me it would, so I believed them. Really had no interest in kind of doing it, but got a job and ended up finding my way down to Silicon Valley in 1999, and worked for Deloitte and ended up at a telecom startup where once a month the CEO founder would bring in a community service manager. I'd never heard of this before. It was the COO's wife. And she would talk about the philanthropic projects and giving that we were going to be doing as an organization and anybody that wanted to do it themselves. And I was so happy because I had, in my heart, had wanted to do something in some sort of like giving or philanthropic space, but those words I didn't even know what those words were at that time. So when Mike Hatfield, my founder, brought this into the organization as a fabric of it, I was just so happy that I could actually pick up a paintbrush and go to a school and do something. And it really opened up my eyes to that giving is easy and anybody could do it. I left that telecom startup in 2003, and I just decided I was going to wake up and figure out what I was going to do because I didn't really love what I was doing before. And I found my way into philanthropy, gratefully. And I volunteered a lot, and I found a small organization that I ended up taking over, fundraising for my salary, building it up over a couple of years. It was an after-school running program for girls to help build self-esteem. I was a runner. I got introduced to a couple of amazing people in San Francisco that opened up every possible door for me. One gentleman who sadly has passed away was around 80 years old when I met him, and he would literally take me around morning, noon, and night to introduce me to people, donors, other executive directors, and say, "This is Joanne. She runs this organization. You've got to talk to her." And the whole network in San Francisco, at least in philanthropy, was incredibly open. And I got the distinct pleasure of running that organization and getting to know that world in San Francisco. And I left that, did a lot of consulting and fundraising for other organizations and joined some boards and was a board president of another small organization and actually another one all in sort of the women and girls area. And then I joined another startup that was not philanthropic. And thankfully, it was a very interesting company, I have to tell you. It was the company that brought the first ever Zeppelin airship to the U.S. since the Hindenburg. So it was very interesting, but it came right in the time of 2008 when the financial crisis happened. And it survived for 4.5 years. But one person that flew on that airship that knew that I was Canadian asked if I knew of this organization called the C-100. And I did not. And I said, you know, I've done a lot of giving and volunteering and supporting of nonprofits, but I have not done anything Canadian, which is so un-Canadian, right? So I found the organization, and I actually now run the organization. I've been executive director for a year. And we are made up of 150 successful Canadians all living in the Bay Area that pay us a little bit of money and donate a lot of their time to open up their network to help support Canadian entrepreneurs build their companies in Canada. So we're all about supporting Canadian tech, making Canadian entrepreneurs successful here, making it so that there's more than the Nortels and BlackBerry stories, that those spawn other stories that are out there, and that Canada is seen as an innovation and tech hub. So I have that distinct pleasure these days of not only connecting with Canadians down in the valley, but coming up here and working with my homeland a lot. So,
thank you, Joanne. It's great that you made the trip. Thank you. And Michelle.
Thank you, Maria. I'm a partner at Deloitte. I'm based in Vancouver, and I have three different roles, which I'll touch on. My one role, and this is the great blessing in my life, is to lead our family enterprise consulting practice, which is really to support the families behind wealth and to support them in their governance and their vision and in their strategy and charitable strategy, really. So that's the one role. I consider it the sacred role. I also have a role as an innovation champion within Deloitte Canada, and so I have a role on our Innovation Council, and I also lead our inclusion agenda in British Columbia. And I think it was Maria that joined all those dots, because there's a very complex weave there that gets to today's title, and I hadn't really given it as much thought as I am doing right now. There's something wonderful about the power of women, the power of cognitive diversity, which is really just saying teams that have wonderful, diverse ways of thinking on them, and I think it takes women to make teams diverse, wonderful leadership capabilities of women, and then looking at families and looking at sometimes those very tough conversations which aren't being had, and to invite families to have the conversations about what it's all for, transgenerational purpose. And philanthropy plays a very interesting role in all of that. It allows the vehicle for the discussion. It's a safer place than some of the other more troubling spots. And so that's been my exposure and my privilege in the conversation. I have three board roles where I've been fascinated by innovating in the field of philanthropy. I say we invert the paradigm where previously charities would demand funds and donors would supply the funds. And now we're saying donors demand impact, and it's really up to charities to supply it. So here we are at Perimeter Institute, and talk about supplying impact. That is really why it's such a privilege for me to even be vaguely associated, let alone sit on the Emmyn Youth Council, with an organization supplying perhaps not impact that we necessarily understand. I certainly don't, but I just like knowing it's happening. And so that's how I come at it.
Thank you very much, Michelle. That's great. So, Sherry, a couple of questions, and just leading off from your comments. So you mentioned that you mentioned how you became engaged in philanthropy. I just wonder if you could speak a little bit about your experience in looking to charities and not-for-profit organizations as agents for change.
Well, certainly I believe that this is where the grassroots agent of change comes from. For myself personally, I believe it's because it's very difficult to see the impact at times. So when you become involved in some nonprofit and philanthropic charities, you find that through volunteering first. I volunteered to be like on the Milton. I was on the Milton Hospital Foundation board, so I volunteered first, and then saw how they impacted the community. Joanne was talking about that. That's how a lot of women do. And becoming involved, certainly like with, of course, St. Jerome's is recognized here, Catherine's here from St. Jerome's, president. And my husband was a professor there. So we, of course, was involved in that community. So we could see then the direct impact. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On a day-to-day basis, pretty much. So mm-hmm. So both of those gave me the opportunity to see that I could put a check in the mail to someone, or I could be involved directly in it and then see the impact on a day-to-day basis.
And did that have an impact on, or how did that have an impact on when you did put those checks in the mail?
Well, you still want to put the checks in the mail. However, and I think Joanne mentioned that there's only about two or three or four causes that mm-hmm. you can carry at one time. I feel personally the same thing. And so you say, okay, I'm going to put less checks in the mail, and I'm going to deliver more checks, mm-hmm. you know, being involved in that organization. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very, very familiar trait, and we really see that with the Emmy Nerda Council as well. So that's great. I wanted to see your thinking on what we see, and I see this, that women who can have significant influence and impact, sometimes we seem hesitant to engage, and I just wondered if you have observed or noted barriers to giving and to becoming involved, and are there concrete things that organizations or even women as philanthropists can do to eliminate some of those barriers?
That's an interesting question. I don't I think maybe understanding what the purpose of an organization. I think once people understand that, then they can see whether this is their passion or not. And I must say, passions change over time. Mm-hmm. You might feel at this time that this is something that you really want to give to. And I think that would be, I think it's okay. You tell people it's okay to do that. Maybe this year, this is my passion, and I'm going to put all my effort and volunteer and money into this. But it's okay next year to say, you know, my passion has changed, and I'm okay. So I think that's it, is that we can give permission to women or anyone to say, you know, get on, you know, we want you to be a part of this. But when I say to you, you know, I've decided to take up another a cause, mm-hmm. and that it's going to be okay for mm-hmm. me to do that.
Well, we're very happy to have you join our cause. So thank you very much. Good. Joanne, what were you going to say?
I just wanted to make a comment on why women are hesitant to jump in.
Yeah.
I run a foundation. I run the Private Giving Foundation as an alternative to a donor-advised fund, and I recruit board members. And when I recruit, you know, men to become a board member, they'll maybe ask me a couple of questions and then they'll say yes. And I've gone and recruited some fantastic women who have built businesses, who have had huge success. And they start wanting a job description. They want to understand what's involved. They're wondering if they're qualified to do it. And I get, you know, Liz, I spend hours. And so I'm going to say that, you know, when you're asked, jump in. That's number one. And what charities need to do differently is, you know, when a woman does show up and is willing and able to do some volunteer work, don't necessarily think of the gala and the fashion show. Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with galas and fashion shows, but be open-minded to the skills that these women can bring to the table to offer your organization.
Thank you so much. Was that familiar to anyone in the room? Just curious. Yeah. Thank you, Sherry. And thanks very much for your leadership on bringing more young women and girls to physics at Perimeter. It's really wonderful to have you as a donor and a friend. Thank you. Lynn. Let's have a little chat. First of all, I'm so happy to see you here because I've known you for so long, and when you were giving your introduction, I was thinking to myself, it's really quite remarkable how you and your family have impacted the face of philanthropy in Canada over the decades, and there are very few families in Canada that we could say that about, so thank you so very much. You do bring a wide range of experience in the philanthropic sector, both as a funder and a donor. And I just wanted to touch a little bit on how you've chosen or your engagement strategy on working with so many different types of organizations and at different times in your life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I liked what Sherry said about passions changing a bit, because I think that's true according to what you get involved with. I think for me, my passion is children and families, because that's been my background ever since I was a little girl, teaching my two sisters, you know, with notebooks and pens and paper. So I've always wanted to impact children and families' lives with my philanthropy, and it's the same really in our foundation. You know, we have a strong focus on children and families. I think that looking at things, there's three things, I guess, that I look at. One is the impact of something. The second is the scalability of it. And the third is the sustainability of it. Those are really important things to look at. And, of course, I've learned that all through my foundation work. And I want you to know that foundation work is on-the-job training. Because there's no books to learn about it. I mean, it's great to talk to people, but really it's on the job. And even with volunteering, I mean, volunteering is on the job training. That's where you're learning how to support, how to help. And I think in terms of what you get involved with, those things have led me to other things and other projects, other things that I have become interested in. So everything leads somewhere, and I think that's the exciting part about getting involved, and I would say that's, you know, what's influenced me for sure.
That's great. Would you speak just a little bit about women in, as women or women philanthropists and how what things we might do to build a community of women and women philanthropists?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, Joanne, I agree. I think that women get too caught up about worrying about this and that. And I was saying to Maria the other day that, you know, we tend to be multitaskers, you know. I find men are much, you know, my husband looked at me the other day after 40 years together and said, Lynn, I can do one thing at a time. And I thought, oh, it drives me crazy. And so I think as multitaskers, we're just, you know, we're sort of torn and we're into everything and we're trying to juggle things and we have families and all the things that go with our lives. And I think, you know, we're cautious about, you know, well, what are we getting into? And the thing that, that I think is important is that it's the most rewarding thing you can do, I think, is getting involved. You meet the best people. I mean, in my work, in foundation work, I meet the social innovators and social entrepreneurs of our time. And they're mostly young. And it takes you back to, you know, kids that they believe they can do it. You know, they don't see any barriers in front of them. And you're sort of there going, well, you know, I think, and then you think, wait a minute, these guys are going forward and let's support them and help them to do it. So I think when I think of women in philanthropy, I'm with Joanne. You just got to get into it, get involved, meet people. And when I think, you know, we talked about what's holding us back. One of the things that really bothers me is we don't hear all the great stories that are going on. We really are missing the great stories. Our news is just all about what's going wrong and how the world is just so sad and torn up. There are so many wonderful great stories, and if as women, if we were hearing those stories, I can bet a lot of us would say, you know what, that's something I want to get involved with. And just to tell you, 20 years ago, I was watching the CBC, and there was this program called SNAP for young boys under 11, and it was trying to keep them out of trouble and in school, and I watched that show, and it was just a little short on CBC, and I said, wow, that's amazing. Like, they're working with young kids instead of when they're youth and they're, you know, in the juvenile justice system, and I thought, I want to be part of that. And I got involved in 1997, and I was just this morning part of a panel. We're working with 6 corporate sector partners, and we're going to scale this program across Canada. So that just shows you, with that one, I've stayed with it. I've been passionate. There's a champion. That's something that gets you involved as a philanthropist. If you see who's leading it and you believe in them, boy, get behind it, because it's a fun ride.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks very much. We'll have time for a question and answer period at the end, so I'm sure that you're already starting to think of some questions and comments you'd like to make from hearing these great talks. Joanne, do you have a few words to say? I think you do. I need to ask you a question. You work with women entrepreneurs, companies, business leaders, and philanthropists from Canada and the U.S., so you bring a particular lens to this conversation. Do you see differences in how they're approaching their giving of time, talent, and treasure?
A lot of the women that are in my world these days are a lot of younger women, they're building companies. And so what's on their mind is probably not giving, because they're giving so much to their organization. From that standpoint, I would love to see, and I had thought of this as of a company like 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, but can't actually make any money off of it. But it's to have startups actually build the organization with philanthropy in mind. Mark Benioff did it through Salesforce. Cliff Bar did it. You know, they start with the giving, and I think that it would be a very great like challenge to put out to women and men is as they're starting to build their company to think about that. There's one founder out of Vancouver that came to our event last year, and he's, I think he's close to making $100 million a year in his company, not a startup anymore, and he gives 10% of his company to charity. And he was talking to some investors in the room, because that's who's in the room with me always, and they were saying, you know, well, if you're going to be like ever raising any money or looking to some sort of next phase, the VCs would kind of have a hard time that you're kind of giving 10% of your money away. He said, that's the way it is. That's the organization. Everybody in my organization knows that. That's what we do. And then that's not the right investor for me or the partner for me with it. So I think, you know, I don't see it, unfortunately, very much. I think it would be a wonderful thing to see.
Do you feel that in Canada we have more of a tuning to that because of just because we are Canadian, or is that something? I mean, you said he was in Vancouver, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I can't say that I'm an expert enough on the differences cross border between the two. I'm mostly, you know, 16 years in the Valley now, and seeing what's happening there, and not enough up here in Canada to see the giving side from it. So. Yeah, I can't comment.
We've met with some wonderful philanthropists in the Valley and who happen to be Canadian, so I just was wondering if there was something, probably a connection there. So
yeah, that's great. We're definitely, as we always get, you're so nice and you're so giving. And so there's all of that, that every single time somebody meets me or any other Canadian will say that. So we have that as part of us, for sure.
That's great. I think Joanne spoke briefly about technology, about Twitter and Facebook, and I was just thinking about the challenges and opportunities you see for organizations. I know your organization is incredibly tech-savvy, and I was wondering if you might comment a little bit on the organizations that are seeking impact for their volunteers and donors and how they send the right messages to them. And are you seeing a change or because of social media in terms of how organizations talk to their potential donors and vice versa?
I think one of the biggest changes that we've seen is in the online giving sector and through the crowdfunding and crowd, you know, sourcing that's been out there. And that's been so beautiful to see that that is now into like the philanthropic sector, and there's actual crowdsourcing just for in the nonprofit kind of area. And so that is so easy for, it's just allowed people to give so much easier, so quickly, to give a little bit and to like learn more about the organization that way. So I think that's been really, really great. And social media, I mean, it's here to stay, whether or not we're using it all the time or in the right ways. But, you know, Twitter and Facebook and, you know, the Pinterests of the world and the Snapchats and all of these, they all provide a huge platform and opportunity for charities to connect and engage with their audience. They have to choose, just like anything else. They have to focus, and they've got to pick one or two that they're going to really give their time to and connect in a meaningful way. So what's amazing about it is now, you know, if I am a charity and I need to build some awareness and I want to meet some people that could help me do that, I might not know this group here that's at this table, but I know who they are and I want to connect with them. I can do that through Twitter. I can get to you guys and I can engage with you in an authentic way and get you involved in my world, which in the real world, that's actually really hard to do. So I think that's where they can really leverage it.
It's really interesting. I think we might have a bit more conversation about that when we open the floor to questions, too. Thank you so much, Joanne. Michelle, so we have a couple of questions for you, and the one question that's been on my mind, because I know you see a lot of people in your daily work and a lot of enterprise and a lot of families and companies. What do you think are the barriers to change in the world of philanthropy, and what are the drivers to change?
So, you know, in answering barriers and drivers,
and maybe you wanted to talk about stressors first.
Well, I think just contextually, contextually that philanthropy, you know, grew up and developed its models in a very different world, and the world's become increasingly complex, it's global, it's technological, barriers and boundaries shift and change, and linear isn't as relevant as it was. So there's a lot that's changed, and some parts of philanthropy keep up and others don't. And so it then begs the question, you know, what holds philanthropy back, and where can we insert drivers to help the philanthropic world increase its impact? And I think you know, in quick summary, some of the barriers are that it's such an unusual sector. It's not subject to the pressures that businesses are in terms of having shareholders. It's not subject to political constituencies.
it can tend to an introspection. It can tend to singular voices. There is no pressing imperative to share information. There's no pressing imperative to reach across and collaborate. So, you know, Buffett and Gates did something quite remarkable when they joined forces. And in terms of drivers, I think it's change in leadership. I love what you're doing, Lynn, and I love what you're saying. And I think we need more women in leadership. And that is no reflection on the wonderful, wonderful men leading and doing extraordinary work around the world. But, you know, 60% of women in undergrad, well, there's only 6% in CEO. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's only, you know, under 15% at board levels. It's enough now. It's an imperative to have women and their wonderful empathy and generosity and natural inclination to collaborate. We need them in leadership in the philanthropic sector. And, you know, we can place those incentives in our work with families. We can place them in incentives in your work with the communities, in your work with businesses. But I think those, really it's in leadership that we'll start to see the real drivers for change. I think I read a study recently, Joanne, you'll know more than me on this front, but I just picked up a line which stuck with me, was that one of the greatest gender differences in philanthropic giving is through the lens of empathy. And this is not saying one's right and one's wrong, but if it's framed with a little self-interest, a man will be more inclined to support. If it's framed with self-interest, a woman will be dissuaded from supporting. So women support poverty before they support university. There's an interesting shift there in the way that we frame our conversations. And so, you know, these are also drivers of change in how we go about it.
Thank you. Those are very interesting commentary. And it seems like it goes along the lines of what we've talked about at Perimeter, which is that in the physics world, we actually have addressed this, that there aren't enough women. We know that there are high levels of women graduating at the university level in physics, and there is this gap in terms of leadership, and we've been able to take that in a very substantive way forward, and thank you for your leadership and your advice on the council. I was curious to know if you have some ideas around best practices in philanthropy going forward, and are there specific ways that you see women playing a role?
Yeah. There are many, but I'll maybe just touch on one because I think it's relevant to us today. The word ecosystems. Women are wonderful at building alliances and nurturing tribes and building collaborations and collectives. And I think that's what we need. We haven't used the word wicked today. Wicked problems need wicked solutions. Really meaning these are ambiguous, intangible, shifting, dynamic problems. What better than women's incredible ability to think in diverse ways? As Lynn said, yeah, Michael, maybe you're different. You know, men, one thing at a time, right? Women, just a different way. Put us together, very powerful team. And so I really want more women addressing these wicked problems. And I think that in terms of best practice, creating ecosystems, sharing openly, sharing our best practices, sharing our good stories, make it open source, got a great idea, put it out there. Let's pick up on that and build on that. And I think the collaborative economy, which is being so wonderfully picked up in the social innovation space, let's pick it up here too. I was at a meeting recently at Stanford where we were talking about the role of philanthropists in moving markets, because sometimes the risks are too great for the big funds and the sovereign funds to put their investments in. But it's the smallest slice of a philanthropist's risk-taking that can actually shift the market behind them. And I think we see it in measure here. Perimeter, we see it in various ways, that taking interested, informed, calculated risks is probably a new way of looking at philanthropy. We tended to be actually quite risk-averse. I think let's go, you know, let's play bigger in the world of philanthropy and take the risk for big impact.
That's great. Thank you very much. So we're going to take the risk for big impact. And I think with that, I'm going to close the formal questions to the panel, certainly from me and from our conversations. And I want to say thank you to all of you. I think that what you've heard is a true testament to the adage, we make a living by what we get, and we make a life by what we give. So thank you very, very much, all of you. So we have a mic, and I was wondering if there are any questions. We'd love to turn the floor over to you. If you have some questions, the panelists are prepared to answer. I see a lot of great community leaders and philanthropists in the room today. We would love to hear from you, wonderful supporters of Perimeter, wonderful supporters and professionals in other organizations in the community. So please feel free to ask a few questions.
Hi, my name is Caitlin McGregor. I'm the CEO of Plum, a tech startup here in town. And several of you mentioned, and it was also in the invite, that you do have a perspective on getting more women to invest in women businesses. So it's not quite philanthropy, but as somebody who ran a social enterprise and is now, you know, spent the last 3.5 years dedicating my life to building a business, I'm just curious the similarities in terms of trying to get more women as investors, or any feedback you have in that area, because we didn't, I know it's kind of a sideline, but since there's time for questions, I was hoping you could maybe add some of your insight.
I'd like to try that, try to answer that. I think one way you can is to reach out to women, other women that you see in the community, either interview them to be on your board, bring them in as an advisory. Again, it comes into, if you get the woman involved, they get to know your organization, most likely they're going to commit their time. If they're going to commit their time, sometimes time is more important than money. You get them giving their time, you most likely are going to get their money too. So.
Thank you.
We're involved at the Mars Discovery District downtown, and we helped found the Center for Impact Investing. And so that's something that I think would be really important for you to look into. And because that's what we're trying to bring together, you know, good ideas and funding and venture capital.
And there's also, I'd say, and specifically for you, Caitlin, there's a lot more we're seeing now investors that are actually saying they are going to invest specifically or only in female-led startups or with a female on the co-founding team. And there was just a Seattle seed investor that was at a conference and made a statement that he's going to only be investing in female-led organizations. And so there's a sea change that is happening a little bit in that. And I'd love to find that name for you and give it to you.
I retweeted it, and it's already been retweeted about 60 times.
Yes, there you go. Social media. Yeah.
Are there other questions? All right. Oh, yes, please.
Well, you know, we also were involved with starting something called Philanthropic Foundations Canada, and that is a great resource to go to if you want to, you know, get a foundation started, talk about all the legal and the different things that are involved with starting up a foundation. I can't tell you exactly what the smallest amount you could set it up with. The great thing with starting or putting together a fund is if you don't have enough maybe to set up your own foundation or family foundation, you can set up a fund, for instance, at a community foundation. And they're a great vehicle because they not only help you invest your money, they might also help you, you know, donate your money to a cause that is important to you and help you sort of direct you. So that would be my best advice. Yeah, that's really important because I grew up in Montreal and we saw that to be a large problem with the the French Canadian population that had only given through the church. So when that started to sort of collapse, then, you know, people were out on that. So we did a lot of talking to businesses and to individuals about philanthropy and the importance of it, and very much like this forum today. And it's really important with your family to talk about it, and talk about it at dinner, talk about it every chance you get. And something that's interesting in my family, my family didn't talk about our foundation when I was growing up. In fact, my dad would sit at the table with three girls and say, earning power is what it's about. And we were like, okay. So now I understand, being a mother myself, how important that was, because we never had a sense that there was money that we were going to get or anything like that. And my great-grandfather was well known in Montreal because he only gave anonymous gifts, because he believed that true giving was not about putting your name on something. So I grew up thinking that that was so unselfish and wonderful. Now, the joke in Montreal was that any anonymous gift that came through, they'd say, well, that's J.W. McConnell. So that was sort of funny. Yeah. But then I changed the way I thought many years ago. I was talking to a very successful woman, and she said, you know, she was actually from Calgary, and she said, I give money, but I never put my name. And I said, I've learned something about that. You know, especially as women, your leadership of your name is invaluable, because if people see your name, they might support something because they believe in you, or they like you, or they know you. And I think that's one of the big, powerful things we have as women. It's not to be showy, but it's to tell people what you're supporting. What are you involved in? I see that with our foundation. People look at what we're doing, and it's the great thing about the internet. You can go online and you can check out everything that people are doing, see what you're interested in, Google it, and the next thing you know, you're on to something. And what happens is that leadership leads to the collaboration that you were referring to, because we have never done so much collaboration. And my dad, who was president for 20 years, goes, Lynn, what are you doing? He thinks, you know, having other people controlling money, and I mean, it just drives him crazy. So it just shows how, just in this generation, it's changing, and it's dramatic. It's dramatic because people are talking to people like they never have before, and we have to encourage that, and we have to, as communities, wherever you are in your community, get people together. Find out what's going on, because it's true. There are things that are happening a block away from each other that are exactly the same. And, you know, they are competing for funds in a community that it's just unreasonable to me. We have to consolidate. We have to bring together great ideas, great programs, and help support them so that we don't see that redundancy.
Thanks, Lynn. Thank you. That was a very good question. And I think, sure.
There's a group here in Waterloo called the 100 Plus Women Who Care. I think this is something that is a grassroots, and this is a great initiative. I think it's a national initiative.
In Silicon Valley as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah,
this, you know, this is what, you know, it's the young, you know, young women who are out there. Tell them about this, and it's a way to even talk to your daughters.
Can I just bring up one thing? Because, you know, we're talking about barriers. I think one of the big problems is that sometimes if you have some money, as soon as you ask somebody about something, they're at you. You know, oh, well, do you want to donate? And I think that's one of the barriers for women. We don't want to be accosted. We just, you know, we start doing things in a stealth manner behind the scenes. You know, do you know what they're doing? And I think that's one of the reasons it's good. I don't know if this is what this group is doing, but bringing people together. And Maria was part of something very important called Women Play Big, which was a group of women brought together to discuss philanthropy, discuss what they were doing. There was a young woman there, I will never forget it, and she had flip-flops on. She was very young, and she said, I've just inherited $80 million. And we all just sort of gasped, and I remember going and taking her aside and saying, okay, a lot of people are going to be after you, and you've got to be very careful to find out who you can trust and you know that. But it was a wonderful forum of women discussing what they're up to. So mm-hmm. you know that's a really great forum to do.
Great, and Joanne.
A couple of comments. First of all, about setting up a foundation. We also have at TD the Private Giving Foundation as a simple, easy alternative, a donor-advised fund. And the minimum for that is $10,000. So we've really made the concept of having a foundation accessible to many. And, you know, some of our clients continue on with the Private Giving Foundation, or if you decide you want your own at a later stage, you can set up your own and transfer the funds from that. So I just wanted to mention that. How do you learn to give smart? I think there's a real evolution happening, and Philanthropic Foundations Canada is fantastic, where foundations actually get together and they share best practices. Community foundations are really great resources in terms of what the pressing needs of the community are. Financial services organizations have now become involved in philanthropic advice, and then there are a whole host of philanthropic advisors out there also. So there's a lot of resources, but we found from the study that there is a gap in terms of where do women go to learn how to give effectively without going to a charity and the charity teaching them how to give effectively, but there's an underlying motive of we hope you donate to us. And so that's something that we're going to continue to evolve at TD in terms of holding sessions similar to this. Other sessions may include how to measure impact or how to read the financials of a charity's organization. So if that's stuff that you're interested in, please come and talk to us, because we'd be happy to. And I love the 100 Women Who Care. When we were doing the focus groups, I started learning about this in Edmonton, all these places. I think it's beautiful. So if you don't know what it is, and it's everywhere now, it's you meet these are busy women. Guess what? We're busy, and we're in sandwich generations. So you get 100 women together minimum. Some have more. You meet four times a year for 1 hour, and you commit at that event to write a check for $100. And organizations, grassroots organizations, they'll have a few that will do a presentation in terms of their cause and why you should support it, and then there will be a vote. And the winning, obviously the winning organization will walk out with at least $10,000 as a result of the event. You'll have all these women who have, not made a huge financial commitment. It is $400 a year and you get a tax receipt. You've connected with other like-minded women. You have learned a lot about these grassroots organizations. In fact, some of the charity that comes in second or third, some women still want to write a check to them also because they really believed. And it's a way to educate young people. So it's great. Thanks for mentioning it.
Thank you very much, Joanne. And I'll just say one final point on that. After years in consulting and advising families and family foundations, that really, I think Michelle touched on this, that these are opportunities for deeper connections, and sometimes the opportunity, really that first conversation, leads you down many other routes. And one thing that we've noticed here at Perimeter with regard to the Women in Physics Initiative and the Emmy Noether is that we invite our volunteers and our donors to bring their children to events. And we had a great event here in March where we had 200 young high school students here learning about a career in physics, young women, for International Women's Day, and our donors and our supporters brought their children. So it starts early, and it's a gift that keeps on giving. Jennifer, I think you had a couple of comments.
Yeah, if I can.
Thanks, Matt.
No. just... First of all, thanks, ladies, for being here and sharing your stories and just your wisdom and some of your experience. I just maybe have one compliment to TD, and I did read the report that came out, but what I like is the approach to the redefinition of wealth and what wealth means and that different perspective that maybe women bring to the concept of wealth. So I do appreciate, and I am a longtime TD client, but I like the difference in thinking. And so to the folks from TD, thank you for thinking about wealth in a different context. To the rest of the ladies on the panel, there's one thing, there's a thread that's kind of gone through, and I do a little bit of talking on my own in terms of innovation. And I'm familiar with the C100 organization. And I think we talked about barriers and drivers. And so just a comment that was kind of percolating in my mind as we sat here is that I don't believe philanthropic activity and ventures are mutually exclusive from innovation. And at a Canadian perspective, from a national imperative perspective, in terms of trying to drive Canada forward at a national level at the innovation directive and mandate, I think that there's an opportunity as we go out and continue to be community leaders to tie in that philanthropy is just another link to driving innovation. I think, Michelle, you made the comment that the risk-taking that's possible through some of the philanthropy can kind of shift a market and get a market to follow or create a market tipping point, so to speak, right? And I think that it was just, I always try to bridge these conversations that I get, get into these conversations, kind of exposure to, I guess. And so thank you for sharing your insights. For me, the big takeaway, other than just some fantastic people to have met, is that I can kind of build that philanthropy piece into the drive for innovation and to think mm-hmm. about innovation yet again from another perspective. So mm-hmm. thank you.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. That's great. Thank you.
I would add to that right now on the innovation front, the big word is disruption and what industries and things need to be disrupted. And I think philanthropy actually highlights those industries and those segments and those parts of the world and that actually could really use some of that innovation and disruption.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think we'll wrap up now if there are any other questions and give you some time to talk amongst yourselves as well, because I have a feeling that there are a number of conversations that were started and we stopped to get into the formal program, and I know you're going to keep talking. So we've mentioned the Emmy Noether Initiative a couple of times today, and I just wanted to just to give you a quick snapshot of what that is. And at Perimeter, we firmly believe that, to Jennifer's point around innovation, I think we've talked about wicked problems, wicked solutions. What we know is that when you are going to find the wicked solutions, you actually have to have everyone at the table trying to solve that wicked problem. And that means that you can't have 50% of the population not at the table in terms of maths and physics and science. So we created the Emmy Noether Initiative to really address that on two fronts. One on leadership and awareness around how you actually engage and bring more women and girls to theoretical physics. And number two, how do we fund scholarships and awards and chairs for women in physics at Perimeter. And I will say that you are in the Stephen Hawking Center. You're also in what third-party endorsed reports have said is the second most important institute for theoretical physics in the world, behind Einstein's home institution, which is the Institute for Advanced Study. So we're in good company here in terms of world-class organization. So we do have a group of Emmy Noether Council members who are our volunteers that are driving this initiative forward. And I thought it would be nice to take just 2 minutes and hear some other voices from other women philanthropists who aren't able to be here with us today. So we have an Emmy Noether video we'd like to show you.
For me personally, I think seeing other women as role models has been the most inspiring. I think it's critical for young girls and women to be able to see women achieving at the highest levels in all different fields so that they can see what is possible.
People just need to accept that women are the other half of the workforce that can be equally good, can be different, can bring their own views, how research is done, how new ideas are generated.
We need to tell women's stories. We need to work on an education program that really works for young women, that gets them excited about physics. And then we need to have a new financing mechanism. So we need to support these women. We need to teach them in different and new ways. And we need to tell their stories and celebrate them.
The women I know have successful careers, but they had to fight sometimes a lot to have these careers. But they do a very important part of science and being typically persistent, and we don't ignore a big part of humanity in doing this.
I can't imagine another place on the globe where you could work with so many brilliant people. The inspiration that they'll get from other people and from what they learn here will give them a lot of satisfaction in their careers and in their lives. So anybody that comes in here will personally become a game changer.
You feel like when there are very less girls, you feel you're outnumbered and you feel scared. And you feel scared about every decision that you make, that it might be wrong. I've seen that as time has progressed, I have actually managed to overcome all my fears here, and I just talk to anyone at any time.
Without followers, leadership is nothing. So you have to make sure that what you're offering is something that people want or they want to align themselves with, be part of, contribute to. And so I think at all levels, Perimeter has a place for people to be part of something that is best in class, best in the world.
So in the true spirit of giving of this day, I wanted to note that in addition to sponsoring this event, Perimeter is deeply grateful to TD because they have today created two new Emmy Noether Awards to support young women who attend the Perimeter International Summer School for Young Physicists. This is a two-week physics and math boot camp where they come here and they're in residence for 2 weeks for 40 of the smartest high school students on the planet. So Michael and Joanne, thank you very much for this. Thank you very much. And I also wanted to acknowledge the other wonderful supporters and donors in the room today who make the work at Perimeter possible. So thank you very, very much, all of you. Okay, so in closing, I want to say thank you again to our panelists. Thank you for being friends, for being leaders, and for being an inspiration to all of us. We really appreciate it. Thank you, Joanne, for the report. And in closing, the word philanthropy comes from the Greek words philos and love, which means love, and anthropos, which is humankind. And so for their generosity of spirit and heart, or caritas, which is the root word for our word charity, Perimeter is deeply grateful to Michael Dye and Joanne and the TD team. I'm also very grateful to our COO, Michael Duchenne, for all of his support and his leadership at Perimeter. This is a very, very special place. True success is always a result of the energies and vision of many. The Perimeter family is a unique community of excellence, and I would like to thank especially the advancement team who are here with me today, and they every day remind me what it means to live and build a culture of philanthropy. So thank you for putting this on with me.